More than just an office, VentureX is the future of workspace. Whether it be your primary, secondary, or tertiary space, VentureX has solutions to meet your needs.
Speak Studios is a community-driven studio space where voices from all walks of life can speak and be heard. You can find them on Instagram and Facebook at Speak Studios and their websites, speakpodcasting.com. Speak Studios, speak and be heard.
Thank you everyone for joining me on Toxic to Triumph. My name is Matthew Pfeiffer. I am your host, and I have on a very special guest today. His name is Leon Walker, and Leon is a self-aware narcissist. So I do want to give a trigger warning for some people. A lot of times people don't really care for it whenever I interview a self-aware narcissist, and that's okay. If you're not ready to hear from a self-aware narcissist from your perspective, that's perfectly fine. But this may not be the episode for you. However, for some other people, they need to put those pieces back together of how people how we have gotten to where we are, not only in the relationship, but quite often they need to hear it from a narcissist perspective. So we need to respect everyone where they're at and they're growing and where they're at with their healing journey as well. So Leon, thank you very much. And tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us where you're located at.
And, north of Chicago. From Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay.
I served 32 years in the Navy, retired in 2015. I have three children. I have four guy children and a dog. I've been divorced since 2007, which is my fault as well. I love reading, writing, exercising, eating great food, comedy, things like that. I'm a youth program, youth development type of guy. I don't like to call it motivational speaking, but I like to, you know, speak to the youth, young adults as well. So that's pretty much myself in a nutshell. And here we are today, Matt.
And when you say that you were divorced, I mean, so 2007, so that's been several years at this point. Have you remarried? Are you in another relationship?
No. You know what? I haven't remarried. And as I get older, not because I'm getting older, but because I'm more aware and I'm more mature. I still make mistakes. I still have the issues. I'm aware of who I was and who I am now and where I'm going. I was in a relationship recently that ended after probably 4 or 5 months. You know, in doing this, Matt, you know, getting into a relationship, wanting to be married, I do want to be married again. I had to do a lot of self-reflecting, a lot of soul searching, a lot of understanding, a lot of wanting to be able to listen and change my ways. And it's easier now. It was hard years ago because I knew who I was. I knew the issues that I had, but I'd never gotten help.
Right.
It wasn't about the medicine. It was more about admitting and the talk therapy, which helped me out. So
tell us. So I'm going to circle back to the relationships here in a second. But when we're talking about because everyone, I mean, I've been doing this a long time. I know you've been doing this for a long time. Everyone always thinks that and they always assume that if I get the narcissist to therapy, that everything is going to work out. So speaking from someone who has worked with people clinically, I tell people that it's not happening, right? That there's no medication for it. There's no, you know, but from your perspective, as once you were diagnosed and you mentioned that you're aware of your behavior and how it impacts other people, what does that look like for you now that you're actually aware? Are there changes? What does that look like as a self-aware narcissist?
Yeah, so what it looks like to me is, first of all, meeting others that I know could be or have the traits. I'm not a psychiatrist, psychologist, none of that. What it looks like to me now is it was actually scary, Matt. Years ago, I had the heart and I had the nerve to act the way that I was acting. I had the heart, the nerve, I didn't care. It didn't affect me to affect other people. But seeing it now, it is very, very spooky. It's heart-wrenching. It's painful to see, to watch, to hear. And, you know, only way a person, as you know, can get help. Pills don't help. You have to first admit to that. Admit it, want it, feel it, understand it, know it. I did my research on my parents, and my sister and I were talking, and we seem to think that my mother was one. Can't prove it. She's deceased now. But on the flip side, the good side, it looks like is having more and moral courage to be able to open up and admit to my wrongdoings. Years ago, I was never wrong. I couldn't admit to being wrong. I couldn't even feel when my girlfriend, my exes years ago, would cry. When they would cry, it didn't mean anything to me. And now looking back on it, I know how I did it because I didn't have any therapy. I wasn't telling anybody how I was feeling, what I was going through. I was always running away from love. I was always running away from commitment. I was always running away from being wrong. I couldn't admit to being wrong, you know? And so I didn't have any pain, you know, the empathy people talk about, the sympathy and all of those things. I was numb. I was empty. And women ask me about the word numb, and I tell them, you know, this is what it means. This is what it meant for me. I was afraid to commit. I was afraid to admit. But then when I started understanding and being able to talk about having mommy issues and stop blaming my mother for leaving me and hurting me and not understanding what she went through, because my mother was raped. My mother was beat. My mother was addicted to crack from 1985 to like 2012 when she passed away from her crack addiction. So I had those traits. I had the traits of my father too. My father was, he could be very mean, verbally abusive. So those things were comfort zones to me, but I should have been comfortable being and acting that way, but I was. And because I didn't get any help, I didn't think that I had issues.
When circling back to, I want to touch back with your upbringing here in a second, but you mentioned some of the women that you would date, how you would treat them. Take us before we actually get to the devaluation phase, that love bomb phase, that I know that's something that you talk about so often in a lot of your content, you know, how you would suck people back and suck people in. And I know a lot of people ask and they want to know, like, is this something that a narcissist is aware of when they're doing it? Do they know that they're love bombing? Do they know that they have the intention on eventually mistreating this person later on down the road? Or is it just something that just naturally begins to occur, things just begin to fade, that, you know, during the love bomb phase, do you actually care about that person? Or is it that that you know that there's something that you can gain from them?
Right. Well, they know going in that they're not going to be permanent. They know that going into it. For many years, women were just, and this, I know I'm triggering, and I know I scare women. That's going to be my issue moving forward with relationships, but I'm being honest, which I never was before. But going into a relationship, they know that they're not going to commit. They know they're not going to be there for too long. Mm-hmm. I never had staying power, and I never thought about longevity.
Right.
Because I knew that I couldn't love. I knew that I was afraid to love. I knew that I was dealing with emotional dysregulation, and I knew that I was emotionally detached. But people have to understand that narcissists have two major things, greed and lust. At least it was for me. I can't speak for you and anybody else, but right, greed and lust. And so I know I'm only going to get so much from this woman and so much from this woman, and then I'll start to not care anymore after a little while. And so I had to continue filling my voice with the next woman, the next woman, the next woman. And that's where the love bombing comes in, that where you start to do all these things in the beginning and you suck them in and make them happy. But what they have to understand is that the love bombing comes from the narcissist knowing what you haven't gotten from your ex, know what you've never experienced. It comes from knowing what you desire, what you want, what you need in your life. And so they master those things. Even though they don't mean to mask, what they don't mean to do it to keep you around, they mean to do it to suck you in. So they'll go at great lengths to master things just to make you feel good, just to make you see them in a different light as opposed to who they really are. So the love bombing is just a temporary thing for them. It's not about having a relationship. It's not about trying to marry you. It's not about trying to build you up to be their woman or their wife or even their fiance or to have kids with you. It's not about any of that. It's about feeding their addictions, filling their voids, and feeding their demons. I had a lot of that, you know?
And so in other words, it's not about the other person at all.
Oh, no, not even close, Matt. It's narcissists are very self-centered, very selfish. And I was telling somebody the other day, the things that I did, I could prepare like a beautiful weekend, you know, plan a beautiful weekend, but it wasn't about her. It was about me enticing her. It was about me making her feel good and important and beautiful so that then we could start feeding my lust, my sexual desires at the end of the night, every night, or at the end of the weekend. So it's never about the actual person. They do it to it. It's an impression stage. It's an uplifting stage, because you can find women that have low self-esteem and no confidence. And sadly, those are the easiest ones for narcissists to get a hold of.
I'm gonna semi challenge that thought process, because one of the things that I hear from people who have been victimized is that when they meet the narcissist, well, I was a bad bitch. I was this. I was that. I was a director. I was this. I owned my own home. I own this. And I challenge people and I tell people that you can have all of those things and still deal with insecurities, and you can still lack boundaries, and you can still not stand up for yourself, and you can still lack the necessary self-love, right, to prevent it. And so what happens is that a lot of women, and I'll speak for the men as well, who fall victim to this, they start thinking to themselves that all men and all women are like that, when it's not true. And so talk about some of those insecurities. Tell us, kind of run down, like, what did you see in someone that you could say, like, this person has their shit together, but at the same time, I can tell that I can manipulate and I can run my game on them?
Well, so first I would start with myself, Mac. Being from Cleveland, Ohio, Cleveland loves two things. They love athletes and they love the military, right? And so
I'm actually from Canton. So a lot of people don't know that. I was born in Canton.
Yeah, Ohio, Pittsburgh, a lot of states mm-hmm. love the military. So going into that with that mindset, I had this thing called the irresistible minimum, right? Mm-hmm. I had a car, I had a clean bill of health, a good credit score, an apartment or house, a good job. I was in the military and had great conversation. And that's all I relied on to get and maintain a relationship, the minimum. And if a woman saw that in me, the military, the uniform, it was attractive to him, you know, mm-hmm. a man that's single, or even a man that's engaged, married, whatever, with his own car, his own everything, that's attractive to a lot of women. And then you throw on the military, you throw on, you know, in decent shape, a decent looking guy, and it's like hard to resist. Mm-hmm. And I got that a lot, because being in towns that love the military, you know, you look like the all-American guy, but I wasn't. And so on the flip side of that, other people that have, I use me as an example first, because I was able to identify that in other women that would have a degree, a car, apartment, healthy, workout, but they were still missing something. And I knew it was like, I knew what they were missing, because they were just like me. I would show up. What would show up with me was a representation. What would show up with me was my titles and my status first. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, like you said, these people are here with their degrees, or, you know, a great job, working out, no issues or whatever. There are things that are deep inside of them that they are still insecure about, because I know a lot of women that have those things, but they can't keep a man, or a man doesn't want to stay with them, because, you know, he may understand that she's onto him and she's aware of who he is. So she feels insecure. She's been left before. She's been cheated on. She's been, you know, talked about. She's been called names. And a lot of people are treated that way because the actual narcissist is the one that's really insecure, really dishonest. Mm-hmm. And so they project that on other people. And if a woman is really into this guy and wants love, wants a relationship, or even wants children, she will start to accept those things that he's telling us. So he starts to build her up and then break her down, where the only person she can believe in is him.
And then tell us once that starts to transition into that devaluation phase, is that intentional, or is that just something that just naturally occurs when it starts to transition to that devaluation phase?
No, I believe it's intentional, because once a narcissist gets to a certain point or level in a relationship where he or she starts to feel afraid or attached or something's wrong, or they have to run away, they start doing the things that they've been doing in every relationship, getting in, love bombing, breadcrumbing, gaslighting, gray rocking. And all of a sudden it's like, okay, let me either pull away, but I'm not ready to pull away, but I don't want to lose to this woman. And I tell people, narcissists don't like to lose. When they lead, they have to take a trophy with you. So the trophy comes from devaluing the person. And so when they do leave, they leave her hurt. When they do leave, they leave on top. As sick as that may sound, that's what they do. So they have to make you look bad or even ugly or call you names or talk about your weight, anything, so that when they do leave, they keeps the door open. So when they come back,
I say that all the time, that narcissist, there always has to be a winner and there always has to be a loser. And if they're the ones losing, then all of a sudden they turn into the victim.
Always has to be. And they do not like to, and I tell women this, you know, I catch a lot of flack, man. When I post my videos, I've been called a snake. I've been called demonic, all of these things. I understand that, but it's a win. It's not a lose. Like you say, they don't want to lose. So on their way out, before they leave, they have to make sure that they hurt this woman almost permanently so that they can come back. And then when they come back, oh, baby, I'm sorry. You know, I didn't mean that, blah, 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 blah. Because they didn't finish doing it to the other person, you know? And so devaluing starts with when they start to lose interest. And that comes after probably 90 days or so. I don't know. There's not a specific time, but if they don't come into a relationship with longevity or staying power, so they lose interest quite fast and quite often, especially when the woman starts to get her self-confidence and self-esteem up. The narcissist can understand that. They realize that because now she may be questioning things, or she may even talk back, or she may not be doing what he wanted her to do, he or she wanted them to do in the beginning. It starts to wean off. And so they notice that. They're very, very particular about when the other person starts to slack off or starts to move away. And again, it goes back to not wanting to lose.
You know, going back to this, you know, this transition into the devaluation phase, and you begin to lose interest. I think a lot of people who are listening would ask, if you're losing interest, why would the narcissist not just on? Why would they not just break up? And a lot of people have asked me, and for those of you who are listening, I don't encourage for you to do this. Well, if they've lost interest, how can I make them leave? Because especially for someone who's struggling with codependency, they don't want the conflict. And so they think that they can convince the narcissist to be the one to leave. Right. But it doesn't happen. Why would they lose interest but not want to leave and still stay around, continue to devalue? What is it that drives and motivates a narcissist to do that?
Because they have to have more than one person. They have to have probably three or four. It depends on their greed and their lust, right? So they don't want to just get up and go away and leave because they have to be ready. And also, when I say ready, they have to make sure that that person is in a non-recoverable stage so that they can still come back.
Yeah.
The door is still left open. So when they damage a person so much, they can care less. Narcissists don't feel the pain of the person they're projecting their negativity on or their abuse on. They don't feel it. So they don't know how bad it is. They don't know how women cry. They don't know how you can probably drive somebody to wanting to commit suicide or start mutilating themselves, you know. So they have to make sure that you are pushed all the way back on your heels, because it's not just about leaving, it's also about maintaining what they've had with you. And that could go on for months, and I've talked to women that have been in relationships like this for years. So it's a thing of them wanting to have the door still open and come back.
It's a need for control, it sounds like.
A need for it's definitely a need for control. Ego to be stroked, to not lose, like we said, again, to not lose, to not feel like they have been defeated, to not feel like they are beneath anyone. And so you can't convince them to leave. They'll leave when they'll leave when they're ready to leave. That is something that is very, very calculating. They don't just say, okay, I'm gonna leave tomorrow, and knowing that you're not really hurt or damaged enough to allow them to come back.
And don't let me put words in your mouth, but narcissists don't leave until you are at your complete devastating lowest. That's the reason why most, and so a lot of times the discard happens when, unfortunately, when someone has lost a loved one, when you have lost a job, if you've gotten sick, right? When you are at your complete lowest, right? Is when quite often a narcissist isn't going to leave when you just got a promotion, when you are at your highest, when you just got a degree, when you're doing really well.
They don't like that.
When you are at your complete, when you're devastated, right? And one of the things that I talk about, I shared this in a video a couple months ago, that we all have, there's a certain level of narcissism that we all have. We all don't have narcissistic personality disorder. That's the actual disorder. But we have it because we need narcissism, right, to make sure that when we do go through bad things, we do have to make everything all about ourselves for a period of time until we get back on our feet. When we're sick, we need to make it all about ourselves until we get back on our feet, right? Someone who loses their job, they need it for a period of time until they get back on their feet. But when you're with a narcissist, right, now all of a sudden you become competition when you lost everything, right? Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, if, you know, because it sounds like you've probably discarded people in the past when they were at the lowest. What was that like?
Yeah, so when a narcissist, well, when the partner, girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever, gets a degree, buys a house, a better car, without you, right, but you all are together, it makes them feel unimportant. It makes them feel like they couldn't help you, right? And so you start to make them feel like it wasn't that important. That degree was okay. I could have gotten a house too, or I could have gotten the same car or a better car. So again, that goes back to devaluing the person that is trying to improve themselves and make themselves better. My thing is, it's like also in that stage, if you see them starting to grow and get better, now it's like you said, competition. Now we're equal. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing I can do to you to destroy you, because now you're on my level with a house, car, good credit score, bank account, whatever the case may be. And those things are important to that person. They're actually important to the narcissist too, because they thrive on status and titles. Mm-hmm. And so when I notice, anybody else starts to notice that the other person starts to gaining their life back, starting to gain in some sort of identity, it doesn't feel good to the narcissist, because now it's like, oh, now she may leave me. You know,
right.
She may have the ability to, she's stronger now. You know, I can't say what I was saying to her. I can't come and go as I please. I can't sit here and watch her cry. She's not going to cry anymore. You know, and so they start to feel that that's when the tables start to turn. The narcissist is very aware of that, but the other person may not be, because they're not narcissists. But when the tables start to turn, that's, again, we go back to the devaluing. That's when they start to like make it seem like your achievements are not that good, or anybody could have gotten it. It's no big deal. You had that coming to you. That was given to you. You didn't work hard for it. And so that part right there is when a narcissist has been affected deeply. But they're not going to tell you that they were affected deeply. I talk about this too. Being jealous. I was a very jealous person, and I fought with that. I struggled with that. I tried to act like I wasn't. But then when my girlfriend, would attain something, a different level, a degree or something, it was like, all right, we'll go celebrate, you know, but I just didn't really feel like I was happy about her success. And I don't know to this day how I was able to hide that. But when you, with the look on your face or your body language, when you're around a person, when they attain something, you can tell, you know, she could tell that I wasn't happy for her, but she would never say anything.
Did you do that intentionally? Did you have different body language intentionally?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Say it again, Matt.
Did you have different body language intentionally?
Different body language. On occasion, yeah. Because it was like an indirect way of letting her know that wasn't no big deal. It was like, yeah. And so it was a way of making her feel a certain way without me saying anything.
Right. And then I have a feeling, because this is so common, right? You do that without saying anything. And then their first thing is, you know, then all of a sudden they're the ones that bring it up. So now they're the problem, you know, which gets
so that's
into.
When it reverse. Yeah. So now it's like, what are you talking about? What do you mean? You know, I took you to dinner. You just got your degree. I bought you a trophy. I bought you a card. What are you talking about? Knowing darn well, she was correct. But I'm not going to let her know that. And now I say, see, now you're being unappreciative. You know, I took time off of work. You graduated. You know, we went out here. Now, you know, see, this is why I act the way I act. Now I'm starting to flip it back on her. This is why I say the things that I say. You know, you said I was a butthole a week ago. Now I'm trying to do things better. See, now, you know what? F it. I'm out of here. And guess what I do, Matt? I walk out.
Right. And you make that event all of a sudden a time that should be a great occasion, right? Holidays, special occasions, someone graduating. All of a sudden, it's now, now all of a sudden, it's all about you. And you just ruin the moment.
Just ruin. So now what that does, that brings about the silent treatment. Okay, now I walk away. I may go smoke, I may go drink, or whatever. I may go flirt, right? Then I come back. What's wrong? You know what's wrong? We had a beautiful day, blah, 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 blah. Don't even, okay, I'm sorry. Now I'm the victim. She victimized me. Now she apologized for something that I did wrong.
Right.
How sick is that? And so, but I was comfortable with that because I had to, again, I had to win. I didn't want to lose. I tried. I did this. You didn't like it. You complained about it. You found something wrong with it. Now you see why I treat you the way that I do.
To justify the bad behavior.
Justifying the bad behavior. Exactly. And then she agrees to it. She may cry. And then I'm glad I got help, man, because women could have murdered me. And then make her cry. And stand there and watch her cry, right? Won't hug her, won't hold her hand. Let her know that I'm there. Watching her cry, and she said, you really don't care, do you? I'm like, nope, you shouldn't have pissed me off.
So talk to me more about gaslighting, because I don't think that people really actually, I'm sure you see it online too, where I see people, they've been lied to, and not justifying lying, but that's not gaslighting. You know, and people will say, you know, people have a disagreement. People have, you know, kind of a an argument, and people won't see it their way. And they'll say, stop gaslighting me. And I'm like, that's not gaslighting. If people really knew how insidious gaslighting actually was, right, they would take it a lot more serious, and they wouldn't just toss that around it like they do. You know, take us, you know, from your perspective, what gaslighting is like, you know, that actual insidious crazy making. You know, I tell people, I give people the example. Maybe you've done this. Maybe you've had it done to you before, where a narcissist will actually move things to make you, because it's intentional to drive you crazy, to make you think that there's something wrong with you, you know, hiding keys. I talked to one woman who her now ex-husband hid one shoe. Just one shoe of a handful of her favorite shoes, right? To make her think that you're always misplacing them. You must have left it in your gym bag and just scattered them all over the place, right? Well, I don't know why you put that there, right? And the insidiousness of it, a gentleman that I worked with, right? Honey, please lock the doors. You know, I want to feel safe whenever you come home. He would go lock the doors, and all of a sudden 3 a.m, getting woken up, right? I thought I fucking told you to lock the doors. Right. And I swear I locked the doors. I don't know what the hell happened. Not realizing that she intentionally went, unlocked all the doors just to have an argument, just to make him think that there was something wrong with him, just to keep him up, you know, because that gaslighting, that and that insidiousness, that chaos, narcissists thrive off of, you know. Can you talk about it from your perspective?
That's another form of control that there, Matt, is, man, I'm glad I'm talking to you because this is good for me. This is therapy for me, but I have to continue talking about it. So one thing that I did that I'm not proud of is I'm a very good listener. Now it's more to understand my woman, my next woman, so that I can change, help her out, make us better. I listened before to be malicious. Okay. Now if a woman said, you know, I'm forgetful, okay? Or I'm aloof a lot, or I'm dingy, and they smile about it. Don't ever tell a narcissist that, because that's when they're going to use it against you. Mm-hmm. And it started off with a test. Let me see if she's going to remember this, or let me see if she, you know, did this or did that. And if it was a simple test and she failed it, that's what I would lock in on to make her feel like she was losing her mind, to keep her unsteady, to keep her on her heels, to keep her uncomfortable, to keep her wondering, to keep her off balance. And I would keep it real simple. Additionally, I wanted to make sure that she felt like I was the intelligent one and she wasn't. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so when all, in all actuality, she was more intelligent than I was. But once I knew that, I couldn't tell her that. I wouldn't tell her that. She didn't recognize it, but I did. And so I went back to her being dingy, aloof. These are words that she used, you know, laughing about being dingy, being aloof, not having wherewithal, being very forgetful. And I would do little things and then look at her like she was stupid, you know. Thinking back on this stuff, Matt, now, it's like, I don't even know how I had the heart or the nerve to perform in this manner, but I didn't care. Mm-hmm. That's my only answer to that. I didn't care. But to make somebody rethink not only their misplacing keys, but then you start making them rethink maybe their parents or their family. My family wasn't really like together, strong, unified. And so when I was with women that had families like that, I became a little jealous. So I was attaching myself to the mother because my mother left me a few times. But then, you know, when you feel as though that she's gaining her strength from having a strong family, that's somebody that she can go to help her recover. You don't want that either.
Anything's a threat. Sounds like anything that keeps someone strong is now a threat. So we gotta neutralize every single threat. If they had a strong family, we gotta isolate. If they are intelligent, we gotta make them feel dumb. If they are financially strong, you introduce financial abuse. It sounds like anything that keeps that person strong, we now have to weaken.
Anything. And a lot of women deal with their boyfriends, or a lot of men deal with their girlfriends not liking their male friends, or with the women, their male friend, boyfriend not liking their girlfriends because a girlfriend may be, you know, giving her confidence, building her self-esteem, getting her hair done, telling her she needs in the streets, you know, take her to the gym. Hey, girl, wear this lipstick. And he don't like that. Because you know why, Matt? That was something that, let's say me, okay? Mm-hmm. That was something that I should have been doing for her, mm-hmm. okay? I don't want her to look too good because she's going to attract other men. Mm-hmm. And if she's going to attract other men, there's a 99% chance that they are better than me. Mm-hmm. There's a 99% chance they're going to treat her better than I'm treating her. And then guess what? It goes back, oh, I'm starting to lose her. So your girlfriend is jealous of you. Your girlfriend looks at me. Your girlfriend likes me. Why is your girlfriend always coming over? And she's not always coming over. We make her think that. Why is she always taking you out? She just texts you. She just called you. Then you just leave work with her and you start making her feel bad about her girlfriend. And now you done messed up her girlfriend and her relationship. And they probably been knowing each other for 5-10 years. But now I injected myself in between the two of those, or between her and her sister, because you're not going to exclude me until I'm ready to leave. And then when I'm ready to leave, you're not going to exclude me. I'm going to leave. Right. I'm going to exclude you. Again, Matt, like you said, I can't lose, don't want to lose. I'm different now, right?
Right.
But years ago, yeah. So the gaslighting is a way. And as soon as she says, "Am I losing my mind?" That's when it's really over with, because that's the goal of the narcissist: for you to not have a mind, for him or her to have your mind. And so again, it goes back to not wanting to lose and wanting to be in control.
Talk about the, you know, it's something that I don't think is talked about enough is after the discard phase, the post-discard abuse. And I stress to people all the time, because a lot of times they think, well, this person has now changed. This person, maybe they're different now, but now that we've had 6 months off or 3 weeks off, and they come back, you know, well, I'm going to do therapy. I'm going to do this. And, or even rubbing the new person in their face, right? Stalking them, the smear campaign, the post-discard abuse, about how insidious that is and what that is like, and, you know, from a narcissist perspective. Because I think that, you know, it's so common, you know, for the narcissist to start to mistreat the person and rub the kids and to try to manipulate the kids and turn the kids against them, the co-parenting issues. I mean, so many different issues even after the relationship is over. What's that about with a narcissist?
So what was that? Say that question again. I was trying to follow everything.
The post-discard abuse, you know, all of the things that narcissist does after the relationship is over, you know, trying to manipulate the kids, the co-parenting issues, rubbing the new person in their face, You know, there's so many different aspects that a narcissist will do to try to create havoc in your life, even after the relationship is over. What's that about on your end?
That's, again, Matt, that's about wanting to be able to come back and not being able, not wanting to you, wanting you to be able to tell them no. In case, and just in case you have the ability or the strength to say, I'm over you, you can't come back. That's when they have to be able to rub somebody else in your face, like better looking, taller, in shape, better hair, bigger house, better car. They have to show you those things. They have to let you know that they have those things so that they can feel like you can't compete with them still after the relationship is over with. It all goes back to not wanting to lose,
right?
Not wanting to feel less than you, and want to have that control. And I tell women this, Matt, narcissists have to have some sort of trophy, okay? Mm-hmm. Once they leave, the trophy is I scarred the hell out of her. The trophy is she can't even date anybody else. The trophy is I heard her girlfriend told me she asked about me. I still got her. She still thinks about me. She still wants me. So the discard post-relationship, post-marriage, whatever the case may be, it's over. It's done. But in their mind, they still have to play that game because it was fun to them. Again, they don't know how hurtful they can be to women. Or men. Mm-hmm. And so once they leave, once it's over with, and they got the new girlfriend or the new boyfriend, they're traveling and doing all these things, they make sure that the other people or other person knows, because they don't want them to feel like that they can get their confidence back up.
Is it that they don't know, or is it that they don't care?
They don't care. They know full well. Mm-hmm. They don't care. They could care less.
That goes to my next question. I think a lot of people ask, do narcissists know that they are narcissists and they know what they're doing?
I would say yes. You know, and so for people that have never been diagnosed, they're doing it. You know, like you say, not only do we have a trait in us for survival or healing, whatever, but for those that never been diagnosed, they're doing it. They know that it's wrong, man. Mm-hmm. But you know what they get out of it? It's exciting. It's a thrill, right?
Yep.
To continue doing that to other people until it's done to you. And I had that happen before. But they know full well what they're doing. Now, ones that have been diagnosed, like myself, for a long time, I didn't care about what I did, what I said, how I acted. Even if I got caught doing anything, I could care less. That was my way of letting her know I'm going to do it again. So you might not, there's no need for you to get upset about it. Right. I was a very sick person, Matt. I was very delusional, mm-hmm. Very, very dysfunctional. I had a lot of issues, but I didn't want to understand them. I didn't want to accept that I had a sickness.
Right.
Until, you know, even when women would tell me, there's something wrong with you. That would piss me off. It's almost like, I tell people, it's almost like being a serial murderer, right? Mm-hmm. Being a serial dater, being a serial cheater, dating, serial murder kills, is considered somebody that kills three or more people. I wasn't killing anybody, but I was killing dreams, yep. Okay? Mm-hmm. I was killing hopes and wishes. So I was considered, I called myself a serial dater, and I knew that I was a serial cheater. Mm-hmm. But all in all, man, I was running from maturity. Mm-hmm. I was running from commitment. I was running from, you know, my ability. I was running from my inability to be a good man because I knew I couldn't be one. Mm-hmm. And so it was always running. It was always escaping. I was always halfway out instead of all the way in. But back to your answer your question, they know full well what they're doing. And it's like, it's the thrill. It's the ability to, want to continue doing and not hurting, but hurting others and getting off on that and seeing people fall and falter and give up and cry and give in and bow down and submit. It was all about that. So they know full well what they're doing, but their ability to not have the inability to have empathy or even sympathy doesn't like make them feel bad at all. They can care less about those words, empathy, sympathy, moral, courage, integrity, character, all of that.
One thing I want to interject there, because a lot of times people get confused, because with narcissists, they do lack empathy. However, they can show it. right? They can show empathy, especially when they feel like they need to, when they feel like there's something that they can benefit from it, right? That if they think that they need to show empathy or show sympathy to be able to get you back, to be able to regain control, to get back in the house, to be able to regain some sort of enmeshment with you, they'll show it then. I always compare it to a used car salesman, right? They'll show empathy if they know it's going to lead to a sale, right? It's called cognitive empathy, where it's very thoughtful, it's very mindful that I can show it if I need to, right? Mm-hmm. And quite often they're doing that based off what they've seen from other people.
And another thing, empathy. I understand how you feel. Others have felt that way that I did these things too. So they are well versed in that empathy. And so once they see, hey, you know, she's hurt. Well, she was hurt too. And you all just like the same. They have the same traits, same attitude, same personality. So I'm going to treat you just like I treated her so that you can understand or think that I understand or think that I feel the way that you want me to feel, right. Which I don't. I just understand what you're going through because I did it to somebody else.
Right. So walk us through what life is like now, right? Now that you've gone through, how long have you been in therapy? What is therapy like for someone with NPD?
So like I was telling the story earlier, my first psychiatrist was in 1987. I was 21. Mm-hmm. And I went to see him because of the event that happened on the USS Stark. It wasn't even about any type of personality disorder, anything like that. It was about the nightmares that I was having from finding the 37 bodies that were burned to death. So we get into the hospital and he didn't know that I was there for the incident. My doctor on the ship just said, hey, you know, go see the doctor because you guys need to decompress. You guys spent 12 hours on a ship with 37 burned men. So anyway, I get there and he goes to talking about my childhood and not even talking about the event. He didn't know why I was there. He thought I was there just to, you know, because I got mental issues. Mm-hmm. I did, but it was something different. And so we start talking about my childhood and my girlfriend and my relationships and my parents and what happened to me and all these things. And he said, yeah, young man, it's going to be pretty harsh, but you know, you're a narcissist. I didn't know what it meant, man. Yeah. Had no idea. You know, this is what you suffer from and going through all this, you know, filling out this paperwork and these courses and all this. I was freaked out. I was 21 years old. And so that's when it first started. This was in October, November of 1987. In December, I was supposed to reenlist in the Navy, December 20th. I come back from the psychiatric visit that day, a doctor's visit, and I tell them I'm not reenlisting, I'm getting out. So I started running. I should have stayed with the doctor at that time to continue my therapy, mm-hmm. But I started running. So as much as I love the Navy, I decided to just leave, mm-hmm. Okay? And this was December of 87. December 20th to be exact. And I knew I had problems then because my girlfriend and I were living in San Diego in an apartment, okay? And this is when I knew, I said, something is definitely wrong with me. And I'm starting to think about this narcissistic stuff he told me about. And the main thing I heard was personality disorder. Mm-hmm. And it scared me because I had never heard that before. He said narcissistic, I didn't even care about that word. I didn't know what it meant. Right. When he said personality disorder, I freaked out. And this is when it really started to haunt me because December 20th, like I said, I was supposed to reenlist that day. I went back to the ship, packed my bags, and told them I was getting out. The next day, I got out the Navy, December 21st, 1987. I didn't even tell my girlfriend. I left and went to Cleveland, Ohio. I just disappeared. Okay? And so March of 88, because I had an RE1 code, I had an honorable discharge. The recruiters were looking for me for like 2 months. They say, you know, you want to come back in the Navy? I said, sure. Came back in the Navy, but I didn't think I was going to be able to get in because I had been diagnosed with this personality disorder, and I was afraid that they would look at my medical records and find out. Right. Well, they didn't. I come back in the Navy, March 1988. We deploy again. So moving forward, I started at age 21. I blocked it out. I suppressed it. But I was like leaving my girlfriend, disappearing, ghosting. This is back in 87, man.
Yeah.
I don't know when the word ghosting started. I don't know when the word red coming started. I don't know. But I was doing it back then, not even knowing that it was a term. Okay. And so I served another 27 years in the Navy. moving forward to December 2014, it was like 7 months before I was retired. And I had been married and divorced and in and out of relationships. And so I was sent back to talk to a psychotherapist, and I left her office too. She started talking about my anxiety and PTSD. And before she even got to talking about narcissistic personality disorder, I left. And I looked at my medical record recently. I was sitting in her office for 18 minutes. So I go back to work here in Great Lakes, and I get noticed that, hey, if you're going to retire, you got to go get your physical done. Okay, I get my physical done. I finish that. I come back, try to check out, give my paperwork so they can start my retirement. And the lady said, well, Mr. Walker, you got everything done. You got the eyes, ears, nose, and throat checkup. You got your teeth, your back. But you didn't get the, you didn't talk to a psychiatrist. And I said, I'm not talking to another psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. This would have been my second psychiatrist, two psychiatrists and one psychotherapist. And she said, well, we can't process your retirement unless you go back. I drive back to the VA, which is like 5 minutes from my job on base. And I go and tell them why I'm there, psychiatric work. And I sit down with another psychiatrist, start filling out the paperwork. And I left again. Go back, and they sent me back. Then it all started to change, Matt. I said, okay, so the negative energy sitting in the psychiatrist's office was just killing me, bro. It made me feel uncomfortable. I didn't want to hear narcissistic personality disorder. I didn't want to hear anxiety. I didn't want to hear PTSD. Come and find out, I had severe PTSD for 28 years at that time. I got it in 1987, May 18th, when I had to go to the ship to recover and find those 37 dead men. So it all came back in January 2015. I started my therapy January, and I was in it for 7 months, 3-4 days a week, homework assignments, questioning everything over and over and over again. And then that's when I started learning everything. I had to let go. I had to learn how to forgive. I had to realize that I was hurting my children. I had hurt my ex-wife. I had hurt my ex-girlfriend. I was running from love. I was blaming my mother for everything. I was blaming my father for being verbally abusive. I was blaming my father for having an extreme personality. I was blaming my mother for having an addictive personality. I was blaming my mother and my father for cheating, my addiction to porn, my addiction to sex, everything, my addiction to being verbally abusive, to wanting to be above and beyond, to wanting to be better than everybody, to not want to be wrong. I blame everybody for all of my issues. Pills don't work, as you know. Pills don't work. I needed talk therapy. I needed to be around people that told me the truth. I needed to be around people that told me that I hurt them. And then I had to confess all this stuff, man. So I don't mean to ramble on.
Oh, you're fine. You're good.
It started 87. I walked out of therapy. 2014, I walked out from the psychotherapist. January 2015, I walked out from the psychiatrist. End of January, I went back with the psychiatrist and the social worker. And that's when it started for me. And I needed that because I was fighting.
When you stopped fighting, tell us what did that have an impact on your relationship with your kids, with loved ones? What was that like? In so many words, what's your relationship like now with your kids and with your exes now? Would you consider it healthy? Would you consider it, is it still a struggle for you? What is it like now that not only are you diagnosed, but you're doing this and you've been in therapy for, 20 plus, longer than that, 30 plus years at this point?
Yeah. So it started in 87, 97, 2007, 17. So what's that? 34 years.
Yep.
So, you know what, Matt, to be honest, when I sat back, man, bro, I was verbally abusive to my children. Mm-hmm. And you know who else was verbally abusive? My dad. Mm-hmm. My father, grandfather never told him he loved him.
Right.
My father never told me he loved me. I never told my sons, bro, that I loved them until I was 29. Mm-hmm. And I'm so going through therapy. She asked me, nobody ever asked me those questions, man.
Right.
And I broke down. I cried because, man, I didn't realize that I wasn't doing these things. I didn't realize that I wasn't even hugging my sons. I didn't realize that I wasn't hugging my daughter. I cheated on my fiance, okay? Mm-hmm. And the woman that I cheated, and that's why I have become clean, and it hurts, but it feels good to say, hey, I screwed up. I'm sorry. I was dysfunctional. I was effed up. I cheated on my fiance and we got married. I didn't know that the woman I cheated with got pregnant. I didn't see my daughter for 6 years, Matt, on purpose. How sick is that? Nobody ever challenged me on that. Her mother was like, when are you going to come see it? All these things. And I'm like, I ain't coming back. You shouldn't have did this. I blame her for me cheating on my fiance.
Wow.
How sick is that? That's why I don't get mad at men to do. I said, man, let me talk to you, bro. Let me help you because you're going down this path. You don't want to go down this path. Matt, I talk about these things because I don't want men to become who I became. And I know you understand that. I talk about these things because I don't want women to meet men like me. And I know you understand that too. I don't want my daughter to meet somebody like me. I don't want my sons to be like me. I don't. I have great qualities and great traits. But on the other side, on the other half, they may have that. But I want them to pay attention to the great things, the great qualities they have, regardless of what was passed down to me by my mother and father. My parents were great. And so the therapy, I had to sit back and I had a problem with being wrong. And you know what I found out? It's okay to be wrong. It's okay to have a solution. It's okay to talk about it. I was a senior leader in the Navy, Matt. I was always successful, winning all these awards. And I was like, I was cocky. I was arrogant. You know, I was like over the top, overbearing. And so when I started therapy, little white lady, 5 feet tall, 110 pounds, broke me the hell down. Nobody else would dare talk to me like that or come around and, hey, man, let me talk, you know, blah, 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 blah. No.
Right.
People was kissing my butt, and I liked having my butt kissed. I was winning awards, and I liked outdoing people, I liked embarrassing people by winning by large margins. I was just sick. And so therapy, she brought that out. She's like, you're a big, bad master chief, huh? I'm like, and she said that to me while I was crying.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it really hit me, Matt. She said, it's okay. It's okay to cry. It's fine, Mr. Walker. You know, you have a family. At the time, I was with my girlfriend for 7 years. You have a girlfriend. You got a stepson. Aren't you proud of those things? But I didn't know how to be proud until she mentioned. I'm like, well, yeah. Yeah, I am. But you know what? What I found out, Matt, and it really hurt me, but it was my fault. I found out that my girlfriend at the time, my kids were afraid of me. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of mind shifts in therapy. But my kids, I had to ask them, how can I be a better father? And man, it hurt me to hear what they said, bro. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how bad off I was. I didn't know that I sucked as a father. I didn't know that I sucked as a girl, as a boyfriend. I didn't know how to say I love you. I knew how to show the love like my father's father showed him. My father showed me love. He didn't say that he loved me. Mm-hmm. But kids need to hear that. My girlfriend needs to hear that. Instead, what I do, I plan a nice weekend. We go to the water parks. We go to movies. We go shopping. I'm spending money. Then at the end of the night, I'm pissed off because I spent all the money. But I planned it. And so I ruined the weekend by coming in Saturday, Sunday, complaining, getting loud, clean up this, fold this. And my son said, Dad, whenever you get mad at one thing, you talk about all the other old things to us. You bring up old stuff. I was pissed off that he said that, but he was right, man. Mm-hmm. So I had to learn through therapy, it's okay to be wrong. It doesn't make me any smaller. I don't have to be verbally abusive. I don't need to continue caring for the abuse that I learned from my dad and to my kids, and then they carried it to their kids. You know, yeah. I don't mean to ramble on, but the therapy is what opened me up. I was fighting and I didn't want to go back, and I went back. And I'm glad I did, because I wouldn't be here now if I didn't.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't be as understanding and open. I wouldn't be transparent. You know, I wouldn't be able to talk about it. I would still be embarrassed about it. I would still have secrets. I didn't want that anymore, man. And this lady made me come see her 3-4 times a week for 7 months. And I was like, but it started feeling good.
And for people who just to bring that into perspective, when you're seeing a therapist 3 or 4 times a week, that's very, very intense. So if you're seeing someone weekly, that's somewhat intense, right? But when therapist wants to see you 2 times, 3 times, 4 times, that means that I don't ever want to say that you have a problem, right? But there's some things that need to be addressed pretty intense, and they need to do it very, very, and at a very intense level. So I just want to make sure that people kind of understood, if you haven't gone through a therapeutic process, that that's what that looks like.
And when she told me, Matt, she said, Mr. Walker, I'm going to need to see you. I had to laugh, bro, because she said, I'm going to need to see you 3-4 times a week. And I was like, what? But see, Matt, even when she told me that, I did not believe that I was that bad off. Mm-hmm. This is after the introduction. This is after filling out the paperwork. This is after sitting in the lobby waiting for my number to be called. And so I'm like filling out this paperwork like, yeah, hey, Mr. Walker, you need intense in-care patient. And I'm like, intense? She said, yes. And then I really knew that I was damaged. But Matt, I was a functioning narcissist. I was a functioning butthole. I was a functioning dysfunctional human being from my whole career, but from 1987 when everything kicked off, narcissism and the PTSD. They never told me I had PTSD until 28 years later.
Yeah.
So I don't downgrade them. I don't discard them when people say, I can't do this, I need to smoke weed. I don't smoke weed. But I tell them, I said, man, I don't even say that I was functioning for 28 years with severe PTSD and narcissism. I don't tell them that. But I know that it can be done.
Yep.
But I was successful at work, man, but I wasn't successful at home.
Yep.
I wasn't a successful husband. I wasn't a successful father. Yep. I sucked as a husband.
And I'm glad that you said that, because a lot of times people who both the narcissist and the person who's codependent who struggles with that, right? They look at and everyone falls for that mask. That, well, and I people I've worked with all the time, they're great at work, they're great here, they're great everywhere else, they're great in church, they're great with their friends, they're, you know, we have the house, we have this. And it goes back to something you said way earlier, right? That the presentation was always nice, but it's the stuff that's happened behind closed doors that really, really becomes a mess. Leon, yeah. I could talk to you literally all day. This has been great, great, great. We're going to have to do this again. I don't want to take up much more of your time. But before we go, I always do this. What, give us something to close out, something that maybe a mantra that you go by, something that you, maybe something for someone who might feel like they could relate to you, or to something to victims of narcissistic abuse that, you know, that, you know, I know that you give a lot of great wisdom on all of your social media channels, something that you kind of live by and something that kind of leave us with.
What I live by, man, is this is going to be two parts. If you meet somebody that's, let's just say you don't know if they're narcissists, study it, learn it, get to know it, right? Don't project it on anybody, but understand the traits, understand the disorder, the psychological or not personality disorder. Understand that. Read it. You know, vindictive, seductive, malignant, class, all those things. Read it, learn it, get to know it. But don't hold that over a person's head. If they've gotten help, if they're going through therapy, understand them. Listen to them. If they are implementing change and they want to change and they know how to say, I'm sorry, I never would apologize. There was no way. When they start doing little things like that, listening, being uplifting, being honest, being fair, pay attention to those things. Don't just pay attention to the red flags, but pay attention to the white flags too. We always talk about red flags. Pay attention to the things that they surrender to, the things they've given up. Learn is very important. I hear a lot of women say this, you know, this guy, this MF is selfish, blah, 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 blah. Understand that we all have love languages, but Matt, you also have to understand that we have loveless languages too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
People get stuck on this great book that I've been reading, The 5 Love Languages. You have loveless languages too. Understand their parents. Where did they come from? Who are they? What kind of traits do they have? Do they even know? A lot of times people say, my dad sucks, my mom sucks. They block the parent out. But you're also blocking out the fact that you have that same trait and you could be projecting that onto your boyfriend or your girlfriend.
That's how we attach to other people, is based on our caregivers.
Exactly. And people say, you know, I know you talk a lot about trauma bonding. Well, guess what? I bonded with my girlfriend because I wanted her to be my mother. She bonded with me, my ex, because she wanted me to be her father. And guess what? I looked at her as a little boy, a little girl, and she looked at me as a little boy. Because we wanted those roles because she was missing her dad and I was missing my mother. But after we started sharing those things, I looked at her as like needy, complaining, want me to be her daddy. That's what she needed. Right. And she looked at me like, well, you're a mama's boy. You want me nurturing. So be careful with that. But understand where your man or woman comes from. Know the love languages. Know the components of a relationship. Be fair in your relationship and be upfront in the beginning.
Leon, this was absolutely fantastic. Again, we're going to have to do this again. We might have to jump on a TikTok or an Instagram live. And I can tell just by the people who are watching, they've really enjoyed this so far. And for those of you who are listening, you can always join our conversations. You can join in. You just need to go to the Toxic to Triumph community, and we're going to hop off here. We're going to have a short Q&A. When you're part of the Toxic Triumph community, you can actually be a part of this. You can ask us questions during the show. Some of the questions I asked actually came from the people who were a part of the show and asked us questions during the recording. And then afterwards, you get to talk to me, you get to talk to the guests. And so it is a great community to join, and you get to connect with other people who are going through this as well. So Leon, thank you very much. And for those of you who are on, stay on with us, and we are going to get into a short Q&A.
Thanks, Matt.